Hi, my name is Allison Mead, and welcome to What She Said, an episode of the LA FPI's podcast series. The Los Angeles Female Playwrights Initiative is dedicated to encouraging and promoting the work of female playwrights, and today I'm going to be speaking with Dorothy Fortenberry, whose play Species Native to California is currently playing at the Atwater Village Theater. Dorothy holds an MFA from Yale School of Drama, and her plays have been produced and developed by Actors Theater of Louisville, at the Humana Festival, Arena Stage, Center Repertory Company, and Oregon Shakespeare Festival, among others. And she's received commissions from Ensemble Studio Theater and Yale Rep, and is currently living in Los Angeles, where she writes for television, including the fabulous Handmaid's Tale for Hulu. She also won the 2011 Helen Merrill Award for Emerging Playwrights. So welcome, Dorothy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, your play begins with a quote from Chekhov, whose protagonists were famously defined by the land they lived on. So as it begins, we meet two families, one white and one undocumented Mexican, in Northern California. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about these two families and why they're both so tied to the land.
Sure, absolutely. So one of the families is a father and his two daughters, Skip, his older daughter Mara, and his young daughter Zoe. And they've been living on this land for a long time. It was in the family of the mom, and the mom left many years ago, and it was in her family, so it was her parents, her grandparents, and it's sort of fallen to Skip as the remaining caretaker. And then 15 years ago, they met Gloria and Victor, who are undocumented and from Mexico, who came over, and they, I guess, 2 years prior to they had been in the country for 2 years. They met Skip, Mara, and Zoe, and were invited to live on the land. The line that Zoe has is they lived in Willits and they didn't have a good situation at the time. So we don't know much about what Gloria and Victor's life was like prior to living on this land, but it's just described as not a good situation. So they've come to stay on this land, and it's a really sprawling estate. It has a lake, it has redwood trees, it has a vineyard that has gone untended for many years. There's a vegetable garden, fruit trees. It's quite large. And Skip has gotten very interested in native plants. So one of the things that he has been doing is repopulating the land with native plants. And you see that that's an interest that he and Victor share, is figuring out sort of what are the best plants suitable for the environment. And I think the idea of native plants, of things being indigenous or things being invasive, is sort of a metaphor for how people also feel about people. Whose land, you know, was this land first? When we think about this country, who first lived here, sort of who were the invaders and who were the original rightful owners?
The native
people. If such a thing exists.
Right. So you alluded a little bit earlier to the future for each of these families, and they're uncertain in both cases. So I wonder if you could talk up a little bit about that and maybe about specifically in terms of conflict and how that contributed to the drama of the piece as it's unfolding.
Yeah, I think, you know, the single biggest theme in all of my work is about the unspoken contracts between people. So in any relationships, romantic relationships, friend relationships, worker relationships, there often are expectations that both sides have of the other one. And very often these expectations go unofficially acknowledged. You know, we don't have written contracts with our best friends. You know, we don't necessarily spell out everything we think a marriage will be. And I think with these two families, they've been living in more or less harmony for many years, but there are a lot of assumptions on both sides that have never been explicitly detailed. And they have never been spoken of. And I think a lot of the reason that they haven't been talked about goes into, you know, who really has the power to speak, who's in what position to bring things up, not bring things up, who has the ability to make requests, what kind of requests can they make. And I think that for Skip and Mara and Zoe, it's very emotionally uncomfortable to think of themselves as being in a position of power or authority. So I think they're very invested in thinking that this is a friend relationship. It makes them feel very good to imagine this is a relationship of two family friends, and to imagine that it is an employer-employee relationship, or that it is has any kind of inequality, I think is really upsetting to them, because I think their vision of themselves, of their values, of who they are, is that they are people who are committed to equity and kindness, and so they would never want to be in an unequal relationship, let alone be fostering one. So I think that that's a lot of where the potential for trauma lies often in the place that I write is, you know, things come to a crisis point and all of a sudden you realize you've been operating for years with someone and you never really had spelled out what would do if it got to this point, but now you realize that you thought of it totally differently. And what do you do now?
Well, the sprawling estate that you described means two very different things to each of the two families. So did this change at all during the development of the play, or was it always pretty consistent in how you visualized it?
You know, I think the basic relationship has always stayed the same, but as I worked on the play, definitely there were things that changed. The second half of it, I would say, was not as developed when I started the process. So I think there were more changes in the second half of it. And that was something that was really useful working with the director and working with the actors on, is figuring out, you know, where the characters land and sort of what kind of a future they land with and what kind of a relationship to this land they're left with at the end.
And how did you hook up with Iama, who's producing the play?
So a friend of mine from grad school, Becca Wolf, used to be the artistic director at IEMA. So she had shared the play with them years ago, and they had done a reading, and it had gone well, but, like, you know, you have readings all the time, and they go well, and then no one ever calls you, and you kind of think, okay, well, that was fun, bye. but, it, you know, I think it had gone well, but sort of quite frankly, I was like, you know. Are you going to do it or you're not? And you didn't, so okay. And I've loved Iama for a long time. I've gone to see their work. I'm really been impressed with the quality of their production. And stayed in touch with them just as a fan. And then I think about a year ago, Stephanie Black had approached me and said they were thinking about programming for this upcoming season and would I be interested. And by this point, Becca has moved up to Northern California, so she had only been a career up there. But they paired me with Eli, who's a great director, and we were sort of off to the races. And it was great because it's a big play. It's eight characters. And I think that's a lot. That's a lot for a theater to commit to, just, you know, schedule-wise and, you know, money-wise. It's harder than a two-hander, and I really was grateful for them for taking the leap with me.
Yeah, they are a very exciting company here in town, so congrats. Your play also features an appearance from La Llorona, a figure from mythology, so I wondered if you could talk about what role she plays in the play.
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, in Cherry Orchard, which the play is based on, there's a sort of a specter of death and of drowning, particularly the drowning of children, and the idea of, you know, I think there's a haunted quality, I would say, to the Cherry Orchard, and the idea that this child's death has kind of maybe responsible for the family's problems and responsible for the situation in which they find themselves. So I was already thinking a lot about drowning and children, just because I knew I wanted to write a Cherry Orchard. And then I went to Mexico to do some research for the play and to improve my Spanish. And I learned about the story of La Llorona. And that, really dovetailed so completely with, so many of the themes of the play. So the La Llorona myth is that she is an indigenous woman who is partnered with a European man. They have children, and she understands the terms of their relationship, right? She understands the contract between them to be that they will be together forever and that they will be a family. And then he does not understand it that way. He understands this as a temporary thing. He meets another Spanish woman. He decides to go have a, you know, quote-unquote real family with her. and leaves the Indigenous woman and her kids. In her anger, she kills the two children by drowning them, and then she haunts bodies of water, you know, terrorizing men and stealing children. And that just, you know, like you do. And it really, really reminded me of so many of the themes in the play. It's just this, you know, can you ever have an equal relationship between, you know, a colonizer and a colonized person? What are the terms of those relationships? But also, like, the power of the sort of mythic and the subconscious and the supernatural to seek revenge. That I feel like, you know, that there are things that are go beyond our normal understanding, and there are ways that I feel like, you know, energy can rear itself and sort of switch the balance back. So I feel like La Llorona was interesting to me as a way of kind of her ability and her strength and her power to kind of adjust the balance of who's in control and who can do things. And also she just is like, she's very free in the play. It's fun writing a character who isn't trying to make anyone happy.
she's kind of a
free agent, and exists kind of out of time and out of space. So it was fun to write for her and to sort of let her loose in this environment. And it also allows things to happen that don't, like, fully make sense. And so when you're like, but what just really happened? You can be like, well, there's a ghost. So, yeah. You just, like, it doesn't have to all be totally, you know, 100% literal, 100% plausible, which is nice.
Well, excellent. Finally, I always like to ask people what they're working on next and what we might be able to look forward to going forward.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm back in the room for the second season of Handmaid's Tale. So that's probably the next big thing. And then all the other projects I have are in pretty early stages of development. So I don't have any new plays or anything. And I'm thinking about writing a novel. I've never written a novel before. But there's an idea I'm talking about, which may turn into that. So you'll see. I mean, I'll either do it or I won't. It's a lot of words.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today and break a leg.
Of course. Thanks so much for the conversation.
Species Native to California plays at the Atwater Village Theater until June 11th. It's directed by Eli Gonda and features Tom Amendez, Carlos E. Campos, Jonatia Alizararas, Eileen Galindo, Tim Rocks, Melissa Stevens, Margot Susi, and Muriel Zucker. For more information about tickets, go to www.iamatheater.com or call the box office at 323-380-8843. For more information about LAFBI's resources, activities, and opportunities, please visit www.lafbi.com.